led to some comic lineups. The starting center on the basketball team was Schartzer, who stood but 5'11", while Hanaberry made for one of the more improbable defensive ends imaginable at 5'9" and 125 pounds. If the teams were makeshift, the program itself was even more so. When Sweet took the job, there was no scorekeeper, no assistant coach, no bus driver, no trainer, no equipment manager, and little in the way of funding. When Sweet retrieved the uniforms from a dank storage room underneath the junior high, he was surprised to find that they were the consistency of burlap sacks. Gray with faded purple lettering, a sports writer would later describe them as looking like World War II rejects. The rest of the gear wasn't much better. The hats were mismatched, and the collection of baseballs so sparse that in years past, when the boys lost them during warm-ups, they'd occasionally been forced to ask their opponents for replacements. As for bats, Sweet started the season with only 5, and knew that when one broke, it would be a battle to get McClard to free up the $5 or $6 required for a new one. Despite all the logistical issues, the biggest problem, as Sweet saw it, was all the rainouts. How could the boys get better if they never played? Thus, his first act as coach had been to walk into the office of athletic director Phil Sargent. "How can I double the games on our schedule?" Sweet asked. "Double?" Sargent looked surprised. "We've got a good team, and these boys need to play. Not just in our conference, but some of the bigger teams around." At Sweet's insistence, Sargent made some calls. Soon enough, Macon had 22 games lined up for the season. Sweet figured that would be enough for the boys to get noticed. 5. Lost in the corn. Of course, to get noticed, a team has to play well. On April 1st, after nearly a month of practice, Macon opened its 1970 season at home versus Pena High, a school of 500 students located 25 miles south of Macon. Sweet arrived at the field by 2:30. He was not the first one. "Coach Sweet, I've chalked the field and got the bats out," said a small freckled boy. Sweet smiled. Sam Trusner was the first and only member of his baseball staff. An energetic, if uncoordinated, freshman, Trusner grew up playing sandlot ball with the rest of the Macon boys. The older he got, however, the clearer it became that he would travel a different athletic path. In 8th grade, the junior high track coach approached Trusner and asked if he wanted to be his equipment manager. If he accepted, Trusner would get to go to the state track tournament, all the way up in Peoria. Trusner jumped at the opportunity, and did such a fine job that when Jack Burns got word of it, he lumbered over to the junior high one afternoon during lunch and tracked the boy down. When Trusner looked up, cowed by Burns' size and reputation, the coach announced that he'd heard the young man was a damn fine equipment manager, and informed him he'd be doing the same job for the football team in the fall. Trusner swelled with pride. "The high school coach came all the way to the junior high just to see me? How cool is that?" Soon enough, word got around that there was a short, industrious kid who could ease a coach's load. Within a month of arriving at Macon High, Trusner was recruited for the basketball team. When Sweet got the baseball job, Trusner signed on for a third spot. Now, as Sweet jotted down his lineup, Trusner laid out the first aid kit, the team's 4 scarred batting helmets, and a small bag of baseballs. Next came the bats, 5 in a row. They were all different models of Louisville Sluggers, 2 Mickey Mantles, a Nellie Fox, and a couple of old beat-up ones. These were the team's most precious commodity. Other than one ancient fungo bat, an old unbreakable model with a fiberglass grip that drained the pop out of the barrel, all the bats were wood, and the team usually broke at least 1 per game. When that happened, the boys made do with what they had. If all that was left were longer bats, the boys choked up. If only short ones were left, They slid their bottom hand down the knob of the handle. This was still an upgrade from what many had grown up with. For many of the boys, the only way to acquire a bat while young was to loiter outside Fans Field in Decatur, home of the Class A Commodores, and ask for the broken game bats, which they then took home, nailed back together, and wrapped in electrical tape. Presently, Sweet walked over and handed Trusner the scorebook. Upon reading down to the number 7 hitter in the lineup, Trusner looked up, surprised. After some thought, Sweet had decided to start Stu Arnold in center field over a junior, Gary Mathias, even though Arnold was only a freshman. Since Glenn was out with an injury, Sweet had also penciled in the light-hitting Henneberry as the first baseman, batting 9th. Thus, the Macon lineup looked like this. First, Mark Miller, second base. Second, Dale Otta, shortstop. Third, Steve Schartzer, pitcher. Fourth, Mike Atterbury, left field. Fifth, Doug Tomlinson, third base. Sixth, Dean Otta, catcher. Seventh, Stu Arnold, center field. Eighth, Brian Snitker, right field. Ninth, John Henneberry, first base. As the boys arrived and began warming up, Sweet walked the field, checking its condition. Even on a good day, it was a difficult place to play baseball. Home plate abutted the Industrial Arts Building, and there were no outfield fences, unless you counted the cornfield in deep right, which at roughly 400 feet was considered in play. This led to the unusual sight of outfielders sprinting into the corn and tramping into a forest of knee-high stalks while a runner madly circled the bases behind them. Sometimes it took minutes for the right fielder to emerge. Other times, the fielder recovered the ball so quickly that Macon's opponents accused Ironmen players of stashing extra balls amongst the corn. Next, Sweet made his way over to center field, which presented a different challenge. Through the heart of it arced the school's running track, ready to upend any backpedaling fielder. Since shallow center also doubled as the landing area for the discus, the ground behind second base was a minefield of divots and crevices. Thus, any ball that reached the outfield on the ground was liable to change direction unexpectedly, or, worse, hit a crater and stop dead. The infield wasn't much better. The mound was a flat patch of dirt, and the loose soil of the base paths housed so many rocks that Sweet asked the players to periodically comb it with 5-gallon buckets in hand. More often than not, the buckets were full in no time. On this day, the usual challenges were compounded by a game-time temperature of 39 degrees that felt even colder due to the brutal wind. It roared in off the barren cornfields, tearing off the boys' hats during warm-ups and giving new meaning to the term wild pitch. Games had been called on account of wind in central Illinois plenty of times before, and this one probably should have been too. Still, both coaches agreed it was better to at least try to play. As the game began, Sweet occasionally glanced over at the sideline, waiting for fans to arrive for the home opener. He knew there wouldn't be many, especially early in the season and on such a cold afternoon. But even he was surprised by how lonely it was. In all, maybe a dozen people showed up. Since there were no bleachers, most stood by the fence or sat wrapped in blankets on folding chairs. All of them were parents. Maybe that was for the best. Macon struggled early, unable to read the conditions. Balls ricocheted off gloves, and routine throws sailed wide. Schartzer uncorked a wild pitch, and the errors piled up, 3 in all. On offense, the Ironmen couldn't sustain a rally. In 7 innings, they managed only 2 runs on 4 hits, while Pena scored 4 on 6 hits. It was little comfort that all 4 Pena runs were unearned. Afterward, the Macon players dispersed into the night, stewing about the errors and hoping the loss wasn't the start of another long season. Sweet showered at the gym and drove back to the house in Decatur where he'd recently begun renting a room. replaying the game in his head the whole way. He wasn't too worried, at least not yet. But he knew if the team lost a couple more games, it wouldn't take long for people in Macon to begin branding him a failure. Then again, he'd been called worse. Some months earlier, a parent walked into a Macon school board meeting looking agitated. Held at 7:30 p.m. in the high school library, the monthly meetings were usually quiet affairs. The seven members were joined by a treasurer, the principal, and the superintendent. Meetings lasted an hour or so, and the board voted on proposals using a simple yay or nay procedure. Monthly finances were discussed, expenditures recorded, and school matters debated. Most of the time, matters tended toward the mundane. It was mutually agreed upon that no further consideration be given to the purchase of another lawnmower, read the minutes for June 16, 1969, and that the superintendent hire a boy in the community to mow the grass with present facilities at the salary of $1.50 an hour. Occasionally, as on this night, townspeople attended. Most of the time, they came to ask the school for something. Money for a graduation float, better concessions, new textbooks. This parent, however, had a grander concern. When called upon, he stood up, looked around the room, and made a proclamation. "You've got to get rid of Lynn Sweet," he said. "That man is a communist." Roger Britton was taken aback. He'd heard plenty of accusations leveled at Sweet. One time, Sweet and Ernie Miller walked out of Claire's and, seeing pigeons perched on the grain elevator, grabbed a hunting shotgun from a friend's car, took aim, and fired. That led to a fine of $50 for Sweet for possession of a loaded and uncased gun, and $35 for Miller. Another time, McClard became livid when he found Sweet in the gym playing basketball with his students after hours, and the two men had engaged in a heated shouting match. But in each case, Britton had stepped in, calmed the waters, and defended his friend. But communist? That was a new one. The agitated parent proceeded with a litany of reasons why he believed this to be the case, including Sweet's reading selections, his politics, and the fact that, plain for all to see, the man was a hippie who'd be better off taking his act to California. It wasn't the first time someone had suggested Sweet leave town. To many Maconites, Sweet seemed more foreign than ever by the spring of 1970. Rather than the town having an effect on him, the opposite appeared to have occurred. Not only did Sweet look like a peacenik, but instead of settling down, he'd become even more of a vagabond. For a while, he lived in an apartment on Front Street, then in a house with Jack Burns down the road in Radford. Now, of course, he lived in that house in Decatur with a bunch of basketball players, some of whom, the women down at the Country Manor restaurant whispered, were colored. At times, it seemed Sweet just lived out of his car. To invite him over for dinner was often to find Sweet, a few days later, still camped out on your couch. Not that anyone ever minded, for he was excellent company and a conscientious guest. Steve Schartzer remembers a couple of mornings when he awoke to find Sweet on the family's couch, bleary-eyed after a night of carousing with Burns, Britton, and Bob Schartzer. Unfailingly, though, Sweet was always up by 7 a.m., groggy but dressed and ready. By 8, he was at school and teaching, lest he break one of Britton's cardinal rules. Have your fun, but always, always stand tall the next morning. Then there was that strange business with the slippers. One morning, Roy Rausch, the vice president of the school board, was walking in the post-dawn hours near his house on the eastern edge of Macon when he'd seen the most peculiar thing. There, silhouetted against the morning light, was a man in shorts and canvas slippers tearing down the street. As the figure got closer, Rausch recognized the mop of brown hair and realized it was Sweet, pumping his arms and sprinting around town for what appeared to be no good reason. "Hello there, Roy," Sweet called out, and then he was gone. This being 1970, The idea of running for fun hadn't yet entered the national consciousness. Runner's World had only recently graduated from being a pamphlet printed out of the Kansas home of a man named Bob Anderson, and it would be a year before a University of Oregon track coach would oversee the release of a shoe called Nike. Sweet was already hooked, though. He loved how running cleared his mind and energized him. Better than a pill, he told people. He began while living in Champaign in 1962, starting each morning by clocking 4 miles around town. Macon was not Champaign, though, and concerned neighbors sometimes stopped and asked if he needed help. Why else would he be tearing off at such a pace? Other times, pickup trucks swerved as if to hit him, the drivers cackling as they zoomed by. Indeed, little about the man made sense to the people of Macon. Still, while there were plenty of words one could use to describe Sweet, communist was not one of them. So when a parent made his accusation, Britton pushed back. Addressing the parents, administrators, and board members, he reminded them how much the students loved Sweet. The man was just a bit progressive, that was all. Later, however, Britton cornered Sweet to tell him what had happened. "L.C.," he said, "you know that one of these times I really am going to have to fire you, right?" Sweet nodded, then thanked his friend for having his back. He was aware of how McClard and the school board viewed him, but if anything, he found it amusing. Sweet saw himself not as a troublemaker, but as a catalyst. In his view, Macon clung to antiquated views, and part of his job was to introduce new ones. That's why he'd done away with the old English curriculum almost immediately. Why he'd taken out the individual desks in his room and hauled in those round tables to encourage a flow of ideas. Why he had his students read books that forced them to confront new concepts. And why he kept giving them assignments, like the obituary exercise, that encouraged the kids to think about life outside of Macon. Getting fired? That didn't worry Sweet too much. After all, he was sure he could find another job if he needed to. Hell, he still got calls from the Chicago schools and from as far away as Alaska. What did he have keeping him in Macon, anyway? 6. He ain't got shit. 5 days separated the Ironmen's season opener against Pena and their next game at home against Assumption. For Steve Schartzer, they were 5 agonizing, interminable days. Most of the players had shaken off the Pena game after a night. Not Schartzer. After the loss, he'd thrown his glove in the locker room, then gone home to stew in silence. Each afternoon afterward at practice, he reminded his teammates that they just could not make those kinds of errors again, that they must kick the shit out of Assumption. Sweet noticed this, and it both impressed and concerned him. He loved Schartzer's intensity, but it could be almost scary at times. At 16, Schartzer was in many respects still that kid chucking tomatoes, racing around the house, and trying to will his way to victory. Stronger and faster than the other kids, he threw as hard as he could during warm-ups, as if trying to impale Dean Otta with each pitch. His mindset, as he put it, was, "Here she comes, boys, right down the middle, the best I got." He turned batting practice into a competition, endeavoring to make his line drives cleaner than the other boys, his home runs more towering. Despite all his talent, Schartzer remained driven by a sense of inferiority, always trying to prove to somebody, somewhere, that he was good enough. Growing up in Elwyn, he strived to impress older kids like Doug Tomlinson. In Little League, it was the boys from Macon, which, though a small town itself, was a metropolis compared to Elwyn. In Elwyn, the Little League coach arrived at practices on a tractor with the baseball equipment perched on the back, and was often forced to recruit from lower age divisions just to field a team. Surrounded by inferior talent, Schartzer had spent much of his youth losing to Macon. These defeats infuriated him, not just because he detested losing in any context, but because no matter how well he pitched, His defense often failed him. So while John Henneberry was backed by Mark Miller at second and Adas at seemingly every base, Schartzer had a few boys who, as he put it, couldn't catch a flu during cold season. In all those years, Steve remembers beating Macon only once. By the time he reached high school, Schartzer had stopped worrying about his immediate peers and shifted his focus outward. Now he burned to prove to kids from larger towns